And on the phone with us now from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, Greg Gagne. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning, Leslie. Mild morning, temps just below freezing, light winds. Pretty threadbare snowpack out there. It's been 11 straight days since it has snowed, and we're seeing 1 to 3 feet of snow at most. Snow surface is really beat up. It's just some wind and sun crust, but still, I was finding some soft, recrystallized snow yesterday. It's been 1 week since the last reported backcountry avalanche, and there's only one report of a collapse yesterday. So things are showing some signs of stabilizing. So today we're going with a low hazard, but this is due to the unlikely probability of triggering an avalanche. The consequences haven't changed at all. If you did trigger an avalanche, the slide could break 1 to 2 feet deep and well over 100 feet wide. Despite this low hazard, there's plenty of slopes that I and many other backcountry travelers I know would still avoid due to the serious consequences of triggering an avalanche. This suspect terrain, we've been talking about it for the last several weeks. Steep mid and upper elevation slopes facing north through east. So if someone does choose to ride in this kind of terrain, consider the consequences if you do get caught in a slide. Is it going to carry you over rocks or into trees? Also, be sure to expose only one person at a time on the slope and get out of the way to the bottom. And lastly, pay attention to any bullseye clues. If you're getting any collapsing or cracking in the snow, it's just the snowpack's way of telling you to ignore that hazard rating and choose lower angle terrain. Mountain weather, yeah, high passing clouds, going to be a warm day. I think we're hoping to get at most a few inches out of this weekend storm. It's not looking terribly promising. Something a bit more promising midweek, we'll just have to wait and see what happens with that.
Geez, let's hope so.
About it.
Okay, great. Sure. Well, the National Abilities Center here in Park City is lobbying state lawmakers for financial assistance to help develop programs that will support our veterans and their families as they look to overcome their injuries from their service. In the studio with details, I have the director of the National Abilities Center, Gail Brill, along with the chairman of the board, Brad Peterson. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Happy New Year.
Thanks.
And so you guys were down at an interim meeting recently with the Veterans and Military Affairs Commission. What were you asking for?
Well, we were asking for ongoing support for our military programs. I think certainly your listeners have heard us talk before about how many military veterans and their families that we see come through our programs. That's continued to grow. And one of our challenges is that the funding is often up and down, and it depends on whether corporations want to invest or individual organizations. We had a tremendous partnership in the past with Wounded Warrior Project. We continue that partnership, but it has changed over years. And we know we're getting the right outcomes in the work we're doing. We're seeing some incredible results. And we really want to partner with the state to make sure that we have sustainable ongoing funding so that we can ensure those outcomes continue for our veterans and their families.
Yeah. So did you ask for a specific dollar amount?
We had not asked for a specific dollar amount at that time. We are thinking that around $100,000 on an annual basis would really help us move forward. That's less than 2%, just above 1% of our annual budget. So it would really make a tremendous difference in our programs serve about 20% of who we see our veterans and their families. So in order to make sure we can continue and grow those programs.
And perhaps more important than the amount is just the ongoing line item sustainability.
Yeah, it allows us really, like we said, one of the programs we're partnering with is the University of Utah's Veterans Studies, and we're working with them to provide, they provide the therapy. Military taught me, stay in your lane. So our lane is recreation programs. They provide the therapy in a non-clinical setting by coming up and staying at the NAC. We provide the fun programming that solidifies what they're teaching during the day. And in a 10-day period, we're seeing 100% improvement in PTSD, and 6 months later, 76% reduction in PTSD. These are incredible results. We're having the opportunity to talk at national levels, but to be able to partner with the state to serve the state of Utah's veterans, we think is a real opportunity.
So what was the reaction from the commission members?
You know, they're hard to read, but I would say that they overall were very interested and supportive and excited to hear what we were talking about. Certainly, we've had a lot of support from Representative Paul Ray, Representative Tim Quinn, and certainly Senator Van Tassel. We are sorry to hear that he is retiring. He's been great to help us really connect with our veterans. All of them have come to get more involved in our programs, and from that said, we believe in what you do and share that with others.
Right. So how many vets do you serve? I mean, now, I mean, you say it grows every year.
Yeah, we're about 1,600 and family members on an annual basis, and that oftentimes they're coming for a one-time experience, and then we're that launch point that gets them back connected to their community. So the long-term impact, as many folks in Park City know, we started as a veteran program serving 15 Vietnam veterans with a grant from the DAV back in 1985. So we've certainly grown over time.
So the 1,600 includes the family members, or they're an addition?
It does include some family members, yes. But the primary number still is of veterans.
So since they're coming from out of state, is that some of the concern that we're helping to support non-residents?
I think that that could be some of the concern, but it's not ours. 65% of who we see still are Utah-based. So we know that we're still a Utah-based organization, and we know that these funds can be directed there.
Right. In terms of the biggest issues that our vets are facing, is it physical impairment or is it the PTSDs?
You know, it certainly is a mix. We see a tremendous amount working through issues with PTSD. We see traumatic brain injuries, physical complications, and some other complications as well. I think what's different than in other conflicts is because of advances in our medical technology, it's not just one thing. We can't just say this. It's a host of different. So someone with PTSD, a traumatic brain injury, and an amputation, that wouldn't be unheard of to see at the National Ability Center, a triple amputee, again, coming through our program. So all of those folks come and rely. And again, we can either, in my view, sometimes be a carrot, sometimes be a kickoff point, and certainly with this support be an ongoing program. Not just, and I know I've said this on this radio station before, but our commitment of our board, and Brad can certainly speak to this, is to not be there for a week or a day, but for a lifetime of our veterans. My father himself is a Vietnam veteran. He did not see impacts of his service until he was in his late 60s. He now has two diagnoses as a result of his service and his exposure to Agent Orange. We know that veterans at this time are going to continue to see different things affect their lives and their families' lives for a long time.
Yeah. So how do they find you? Word of mouth?
Word of mouth is certainly one way, but we reach out. We've got great, great partnerships. Gary Harder, the Utah ED with the Utah Department of Veteran and Military Affairs, they've been a huge partner for us locally. The Salt Lake VA, although we work with other VAs, the Salt Lake VA is one of the strongest in our country, and it's great to have them here to help us connect them. And then word of mouth, veterans to veterans, warriors to warriors, is really strong.
Yeah. So is it that you have to accept them, or anybody's welcome, or how does that work?
We're going to make it work. We're adaptive. We are always going to help that person in need. There are sometimes limitations we have in our program availability and our equipment in specific. So if we can't accept them for that specific program, we've got several coming up this month, then we would refer them to an upcoming activity that they could get involved in.
Yeah. So what is it that you do for them?
We do a tremendous amount for them, and I think it's hard to summarize very quickly, but any of our program activities, so any of those outdoor activities, we can get them out and active again. Some of them were that action sports person, that action guy or woman, and that action gets taken away from them. And so we can help them continue to be active and get outdoors. Other folks are coming for social connections. Some are coming for family bonding. Certainly when you're coming back from conflict and reconnecting both with your community but also with your immediate family, that can be really hard. And we've got a creative program, which I invite other people to learn about, called the Equine Assisted Learning Program, where you're working on communication, including nonverbal communication, and building that family unit. So those are just some of the ways that we connect with veterans. And then when we partner, like I said earlier, with therapeutic programs or other programs, we can even amplify the results.
So with those kind of numbers, I mean, we're seeing more than 100 people a month come through the center. Do you have a staff member dedicated? I mean, Brad, is this something that the board sees as a real need to fund?
For sure. One of the aspects that I have been come to really appreciate about the board, or about the National Ability Center since I joined, is just our overall impact on, you know, the entire military community, especially throughout the entire state. So prior to joining the board, I was a director of outdoor recreation for the state of Utah, appointed by Governor Herbert to go oversee all things outdoor rec. During that time, I was able to go and meet with all these different communities and mayors and county commissioners and realized that, you know, every one of those communities actually have military veterans who are looking for support. We're able to come up here, bring them locally into the Park City, into our local programming, teach them how to go out there and do these adaptive recreational opportunities, send them back to, you know, their local communities and go and help them just to regain their own confidence in their lives and overcome these fears that they've actually experienced along the way. So, you know, at this point, we truly have this amazing experience to go out there and influence the entire state of Utah, not just what's here locally.
Well, it sounds like it's a unique experience as well, and a unique that's not offered then statewide through.
Correct. You know, just a couple of months ago, I was attending the Utah Office of Outdoor Recreation annual conference at Snowbird. Both the BLM State Park and State Parks came up to me and asked if we would, you know, go out there and actually advise them as they're building new recreational facilities and they're building new campsites. Would the NAC partner with them to show them how we can help them to make these more adaptive? You know, the state, and not just the state of Utah, but we're finding it more and more across the country. They need this advice and this counsel as to how to support this growing movement on adaptive recreation. And I think the NAC is well positioned to go out there and play that part.
Yeah. So is the money that we're asking for the state then to be used for staff and equipment? Is that where it would...
No, primarily for scholarships in order to continue the programming at a sustainable level. We have got some other great community support for staffing, and I would say we do have a dedicated military position. We also have a commitment as an organization, and we encourage everybody and that we can talk to hire veterans, and we continue to do that throughout our organization and our staffing. I'd also just emphasize what Brad said and add in that through our recent merger with Splore, not so recent, about a year ago this time, we are able to provide programming not just in Park City but across the state. So we have that mobile option. We have an option for those veterans that really want a more adventure backcountry option to get out there with us for multi-day adventures.
Yeah. Well, we know what it costs to go skiing for a week, you know, of a family of a few. So the scholarship, what does it pay for? Is that what we're talking about? Lodging, lift tickets, meals, all of that?
You know, it certainly does help offset the cost of lodging and the programming and some of that equipment, but it's not, these dollars won't go specifically to buy pieces of equipment. And our team who is providing expertise, whether it's a volunteer or a staff member in providing that program. I would give a shout out to our ski partners, Vail and Park City Mountain, and their Epic Promise program stepped up big again this year. Deer Valley has always been a great supporter, and both of them are very, very committed to our veteran programs and to our veterans overall.
Okay. In a couple of minutes we got left, can we talk a little bit about the expansion plans, where we are with that?
Yeah, we had a great meeting with the city back in December. And as far as the work that we're doing at the ranch, we got approval to go forward. So we're really excited about that opportunity to continue to make strides to do some build outs there. Our estimation is we would for sure break ground on our first project in this year of 2018, if we were lucky, possibly two. The fundraising continues, so we certainly welcome anyone who's interested in learning how they can get involved. We officially announced the campaign in September of 2017. We're at around 11.6 million right now, but we've got quite a bit still left to go to do all the projects, which again are going to take many years to deliver on.
With a goal of 15 million.
Oh, that's the total target there.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about the projects that you hope to get underway this year.
Well, one is at the ranch, and it's an expansion to our equestrian facility. If anyone has been there, and if not, come on by. We would love to get you involved. You'll know that you kind of walk in, and you just go into the arena area. We have one converted stall that we use for staff and volunteers and parents that get cold. So we're going to add in some more training space when we partner with groups like the VA and others. San Diego Naval Medical Center is one of our great veteran partners that comes out. They need just spaces to meet. So there will be some meeting space in there, and then a therapy room for a hippotherapy program, an area for families to stay warm while they watch their kids participate in program, and a little more areas for staffing. And then the other area that we have been working diligently with the city and Park City Mountain, we made that great announcement with Park City Mountain of a 50-year lease, is to build a new mountain center at the base of Park City Mountain. We're really excited about that. We're working through that process and trying to go through the approvals there as well. If we can get that all done, we know we have a short window to build in that area from April to November. So we'll hopefully be moving forward quickly there.
Right. And that is in a similar location where you're at now?
It's a little bit lower, mm-hmm. kind of where those...
on the other side of Pigpen?
Two magic carpets are. Yeah. It impacts one of those magic carpets that will help relocate.
Okay. Anything else you two want to mention?
Well, ED has to always say we have great opportunities to get involved. So volunteering, we could use volunteers any Saturday this month. We are about 20 people short for this Saturday, and that trend continues for the next several. Those are both for local programs, veteran programs, and all of the other things that we do, visitors that are in town. And then the other thing for those that love our Red, White, and Snow event, tickets went on sale yesterday. There is some miscommunication sometimes that we're sold out automatically. One event is often sold out very quickly, maybe two. That's the gala and Wine on the Mountain. There are plenty of tickets and plenty of ways to get involved. So discovernec.org or redwhiteandsnow.org are great ways to check that out.
Okay, and then real quick, in terms of volunteer, is there a minimum age or do you have to be a skier?
We do have a peer partner program, and I believe that minimum age is 12, but certainly check with us on that one. And then other than that, yes, you do need to be able to ski, and there are trainings available. Certainly contact us and we'll get you the information you need, but at the very least, we just need someone to ski behind. We know how busy these mountain trails are right now, and that's can be very dangerous when you're doing adaptive programming. So we just need help in keeping people in the right places as we ski down with folks with disabilities.
Okay. I think the one thing that's interesting, too, just about volunteering is it becomes less and less about actually volunteering and more about building this relationship with the people who are actually there and learning about their lives and learning about these military vets and how they ended up there. And, you know, you end up forming a bond with them and kind of extending that beyond the National Ability Center, too.
Okay. Brad Peterson, Gail Brill, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Coming up now at 8:30, good morning, where the Park City Council got the results of the first phase of a study from short-term housing consultant Brumby McLeod and had another joint discussion with the Park City Planning Commission about the future of Treasure Hill. In the studio with a recap, newly seated council member Steve Joyce. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
Hey, before we start, let's talk a little bit about the decision you had to make, whether or not to continue serving on the Planning Commission or say, yes, I'm going to serve what I was elected to do.
Yeah, they actually gave me the opportunity, even though I would be seated as city councilor, to continue with the Treasure Pieces Planning Commission. And it just made sense since the city council was already going to be essentially down to three if you pulled me out, because we're missing Andy's replacement. And down to three, that starts to get iffy if, you know, all of a sudden somebody's sick or something like that. You literally lose a quorum, and we can't afford to do that. So there was some good reason to keep me as a city councilor voting on that side. And once, you know, Adam was staying around and Preston was staying around, and you've got six of the seven city planning commissioners, it just really didn't matter. I mean, it's I'll be able to participate from either side, so I think that was the best bet for us.
All right. The planning staff and applicant hope to have more detail in next week's meetings, both at the Planning Commission on Wednesday and the City Council on Thursday. Do we have a deadline on a decision of whether or not we continue down this road or just say, you know what, it's back before the Planning Commission?
We've got about 2 weeks. I think we get to, I think the magic date was the 24th for the Planning Commission and the 25th for City Council. The City Council meeting is moved from its normal Thursday back to Tuesday. So it'll be the 23rd for City Council and the 24th for the Planning Commission. And but every time we kind of have this, is there a drop dead thing? So when we get to the two big meetings next week, You know, if there was something that was just a catastrophic stop to the, you know, a big disagreement, which fortunately we're not seeing at all yet. Everything seems to be working happily along. We could pull the plug or change direction. But right now we're looking at 2 weeks, 3 weeks.
So the city council on the 23rd would be voting for a settlement agreement.
Yes.
And I guess that gives the green light for the planning commission to say, well, I mean, a settlement agreement can be approved, but what if the planning commission doesn't approve of the plans?
So the city council, before I became part of it, was actually gave a very strong answer, which I was happy with as a planning commissioner, that said, if the planning commission does not support this alternative, then we'll pull the plug on it. Now, hopefully the answer is if the planning commission doesn't support it, there's some handful of things that would need to be fixed, and perhaps that can be turned around pretty quickly and we can proceed. But the city council was very strong about wanting to make sure that the planning commission really approved and supported this decision of the settlement agreement and the proposed development.
Okay, the planning commission gets the last word on this then.
Yeah, yeah.
By next week, the applicant said that they hope to have square footage on the boutique hotel, as well as the location, access, street engineering, conceptual site plan, and road layout for those 18 homes. What are you going to be looking for?
I think I'm kind of adopting Tim Henney's approach, which I think is a nice one, which is the Planning Commission has spent so much time on this and is so deep into the details of what all the issues and problems and things were, that the City Council is kind of sitting back, letting the Planning Commission kind of drive the discussions about, you know, how much is too much excavation and what does it mean to put dirt up on the hill and what are the mitigating factors for the 15 conditional use categories. And so I think the City Council is really kind of waiting to hear back either support or not from the Planning Commission. And of course, there's the whole business side of this that the Planning Commission's not involved in, of, you know, how payments are made and when and what and all that kind of thing. That's a more of a city council issue. But I think we're kind of waiting to see what we hear. For me, the obvious things, if you go back and look at the 17.2 version of the treasurer proposal, you pretty much have our list of issues of, you know, what we were concerned about and what we kept asking about and drilling into details on. And it's going to be the same thing. So it's space and traffic and parking and excavation and, you know, impact on the neighborhood.
So any of those could be a deal killer.
They could, but I really get the sense right now. I'm cautiously optimistic that, you know, if we had a somebody coming in as the new applicant, Park City 2, if they came in as the new applicant and had, you know, grandiose plans and were really pushing against the limits of what, you know, even at half the density they could do, I would be concerned. But it seems like just, you know, I'm not in the meetings. It's mostly being driven out of the planning department and the engineering department and the applicant. But I'm hearing that everybody's kind of getting things through. When they have disagreements, they kind of find a good middle ground and move on pretty quickly. So it's looking good.
But back to the Planning Commission, if the $24 million bond does not get approved, huh?
Yeah, then we go right back. The one thing that people, there would be some little glitch there that I don't know how it would quite work out, but there's part of what the $6 million down payment would be. So that says we've moved through the settlement agreement, but we didn't get to the bond. That buys down 10% of the density. But the assumption is that if we get to a bond that doesn't pass, then almost immediately we'd go right back in and basically be moving to a vote.
What about workforce and affordable housing requirements? Does it get built on site, or do they have to do it? Or
they definitely will have affordable housing requirements. We haven't seen what the number is, and there's going to be some kind of interesting trade-offs. I mean, normally what we push for is on-site affordable housing. But at the same time, we're really trying to diminish the size of what's up there. I don't know what they're going to come up with. I can see there will at least be something. It'll either be built up there, built somewhere else, or a fee in lieu. And certainly with all the affordable housing projects that the city's working on, we have no shortage of places to put the money to work. So
what about the cabriolet? Does that go away?
The current plan is that we will live with the town lift as it exists now. So the whole kind of two-step funicular cabriolet up and then a quad up from there. will not be supported in the current plan. But from what I understand, everything they're doing says, hey, we may come back in the future and do something like that. But I've heard that instead of kind of doing get off of one lift and get on to the other kind of thing, that it might be something more like a gondola with a stop or something like that, or a quad lift with an intermediate stop. But that's way down the road. So I think the thing we'll see as a proposal leaves that as a future potential, but we've got the town lift.
Right. I guess that traffic, though, was a big concern of the Planning Commission. So that means that if any of those guests or residents want to come to Main Street, they're going to have to get in their car and come down.
Well, I hope not, because if you think about it, the town lift, I can look, it's just right over there, about a block and a half away, and there's stairs and things that are there. Part of the whole project has been to add stairs and to improve stairs. And so, yeah, I guess there'll be some people who won't walk the block and a half over to Main Street, but hopefully not.
Planning Commission Chairman Adam Strawn said that he thinks the time frame is incredibly tight. He isn't sure that we could be ready by next week. So as a former member of the Planning Commission, and you've been working on the details for the last 18 months, I mean, wouldn't you kind of agree with him?
I'm hopeful. I guess that's the thing. I think this is not clearly the normal process that we would go through for a development, but I think it's an opportunity that we have to push hard, and maybe we won't have all the detail we would love to have, but I think the real key is if we can get to some pretty strong caps that say for, you know, net space and gross space and parking, you know, we don't necessarily have all the parking designed, so you have everything of how it's going to flow, but you know that you're going to have this many square feet and this many parking spaces. That's going to be enough to address a lot of the issues, I think. And again, I'm not going to speak for the Planning Commission anymore, but it would certainly be enough for me, I think, personally.
Yeah, I mean, so you don't feel like we're getting a half-baked plan here? And that's really what got us to the issue that we're at now, is that we had a master plan that did not define very specifically things.
Yeah, I think the challenge is what we've seen is plans that have tremendous amount of detail. If you look at the proposals going back to 2003, 2004 from the Sweeneys as the applicants, they've had beautiful architectural renderings and detail everywhere. But the issue was more of just the overall size and mass and scale and those kinds of things. And so I think this time what we're doing is coming at it the other direction, that says you may not have all the beautiful architectural renderings, although they have actually just hired an architect, which I thought was nice. That was a request of the Think Group. But if you had all the, here's the size and the bulk and the agreed to amount of commercial space and all those kinds of things, then you can really address most of the impacts on the community without knowing exactly what a building looks like.
Resident Rich Wyman asked why the city isn't trying to move the entire project down to the base of Park City Mountain Resort, since Vail has intentions to build out some 800,000 square feet there. I mean, why don't we just make that bigger?
I appreciate it. It's good ideas. And I think keep it coming, because I think people are listening. But at some point, from a city's perspective, the answer is this is all about buyers and sellers and landowners who have master plans. And, you know, if the applicants, if Vail doesn't want to do this, or there was mention of the King's Crown, if Rory doesn't want to do this, or if the Park City 2 people, if Liz doesn't want to do this, the city can't go, here's what you have to do with your land. I mean, that's just not going to fly. And so I know people have a wish list of seeing absolutely nothing up above their houses, but I keep telling folks, the way you fix that is you get in a time machine and go back to 1984 and change what happened. Because now that's just, there's a master plan in place and there's some real commitments, and we have to kind of work within that structure.
Let's move on to short-term rentals. Was a price tag discussed at all yesterday? Do we know how much we're paying for this study? I mean, I've asked a couple people.
Yeah, Diane heard you ask, so she made sure I had the answer. It's actually between the three bodies, which was the chamber, the county, and the city. It was $25,000 split in thirds, so our part would obviously be $833.
Yeah, so that's for the first phase, or that's an entire study?
I think that's just the first phase, and I think the second phase is kind of to be determined, because we don't even know exactly what we would be looking for, so it'd be hard to kind of price out.
And you feel like this is a good way to spend tax dollars?
I think it is. I think this is, I mean, clearly when you look at things that have an impact on the town, I wrote down just a few numbers that were kind of the stunning ones to me. One thing is they found within Park City, it was 30, this was off of HomeAway, which is people know as VRBO and Airbnb. There were 3,209 listings. And yet we have roughly 2,100 business licenses. So that says we have 1,100 people who have listings that don't have business licenses, which mean their places aren't being inspected. It makes it a lot less likely that they're paying taxes. But the other thing that hit me was just the I'll read through these real quick. It was roughly almost 11,000 houses in town. 1,800 were full-time people. 1,200 were long-term rentals. And that left 7,600, which is 71%, that which he described as vacant. Now, vacant could mean short-term rentals. But it was stunning to me to think that there's three-fourths of the places in our town that are either short-term rentals or second homes that stay vacant. I mean, that's just huge. I think the way that this data gets used is we've seen the legislature make some efforts to keep municipalities like Park City from legislating the Airbnbs and VRBOs, just like they've done with the Ubers and Lyfts. There was an effort last year to do that. We kind of fought back and held our ground a little bit. But this is the first time I think anybody's going to be able to walk in with numbers that really talk about the amount of impact that's going on. And I think it'll be very helpful to us working with the Utah legislature.
So what's the difference between Airbnb and nightly rentals, or are they one of the same?
I mean, Airbnb is just, you know, basically the website. It's a marketing avenue for renting your short-term rental. But in Park City, everything that's rented out for less than 30 days is a short-term rental, whether it was done through VRBO or you rented it out to your buddy or whatever. It doesn't matter.
So what should we expect then from phase two? I mean, do we hope to consider more restrictive ordinances on this?
I think we're looking for that as an opportunity. And it could be as simple, I mean, based on what we've heard from other cities where they've done this, it could be as simple as education process to people as to if you're going to do VRBO or Airbnb, you know, what is it that you really have to do? We could tighten up some restrictions here in town. We could do more work to make sure that we're really out doing all the inspections that we need to do. We could address some of the people who we clearly know don't have business licenses. And I don't think we're looking for any kind of, you know, vindictive approach to start charging them with stuff. But I think we're looking at trying to get them in the loop. I don't think we're going to be able to just really control this. But if we can manage it so it's more fair to the lodging industry and manage it so it's safer for the people that that are staying there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would ask, I mean, if a home is safe for a permanent occupant, why wouldn't it be for the short-term renter?
The easiest example is you get somebody, you know, when you go into a house, if you were doing an architectural design and the city was inspecting it, you have to have egress, fire egress from anything that's a bedroom. Well, so all of a sudden you've got this office down the hall and you decide to rent that out as a bedroom. It has no windows. It has no egress. We don't get to inspect it if we don't know it exists. And now all of a sudden you've got a life hazard. And so that's the kind of thing that an inspection would catch, just like it does as part of the building process.
So what do you think that the city's position should be with allowing rentals in neighborhoods that have CCNRs that don't allow them? Right now the city doesn't enforce CCNR, so why would we hear?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting thing that, you know, a CCNR is really an agreement between the residents. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of an odd one. There's actually a few little niche neighborhoods in town that it was actually part of a plat amendment that said no nightly rentals. But that's the exception. So it's kind of hard for the city to step in between you and somebody at your neighbors who have an agreement, which is the CCNRs, and for us to suddenly come in and be the enforcement arm. It just doesn't work. It would be one thing for us to respect a community CCNRs with the things that we're doing, you know, for our actions and promotions and things like that. But we're not going to get into the enforcement side of things. So we just look at it from what's already part of the Park City Code. You have to have a business license to run a business here, and renting out a room is a business. If you're doing any kind of lodging, then you have to have an inspection to make sure that your place is safe. We're not looking to do anything really kind of above and beyond what's already part of our code.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, it's just it's fun to kind of be on the other side of things and get to start as a city councilor. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay. Steve, hey, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Kevin Van Tassel has announced he will not be seeking re-election in 2018, and this will be his final legislative term. He joins me now on the phone to tell us what to expect this final term and then what's next for him. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. So after two six-year terms, you've just had enough?
Well, it's 3 4-year terms. So.
Okay.
Yeah, well, you know, I didn't, when I started to run, I've always felt like get in, try to do all you can, and then there's a time to leave, and 12 years is long enough for me. I've made that decision and appreciate being able to serve the people, and we've done some good things, and it's time for new ideas and other people to take that opportunity. I look forward to seeing who runs and continue a great path here in the state of Utah.
So do you have any interest in the U.S. Senate seat vacated by Orrin Hatch?
No, I do not. The calendar continues to roll, even though we'd like to stop it. And probably in the next couple of years, my wife and I will go on a service mission for the church and do some things like that we wanted to do. Catch up with a bunch of grandkids that I haven't had much association with the last 12 years.
All right. But in terms of your replacement, I mean, could a Democrat ever win in this district?
Oh, I think if they possibly could, they'll have to be, I think, a moderate Democrat. I'm not sure that a real progressive could win, but, you know, you never know. It would be a challenge for a Democrat to win, but the right person might be able to do that. I don't. It's hard to say.
Yeah.
The issue is that in my opinion, this district needs to be one that works the middle and accomplishes things for both sides. If you are on the fringe, if you're on the far right or the far left, it's difficult to get a lot done, and because your options are so few. But that's my personal opinion.
What about a woman? We of course have Joni Crane from your neck of the woods, who says that she plans to run.
Yeah, Joni says I think, you know, there's nothing. We've got five or six female senators. I think they have as good an opportunity as anyone else.
We'll kind of save the questions about, you know, what you're most proud of and what you kind of regret for maybe after the legislative session. Let's focus on what's coming up here. Of course, the session starts on January 22nd, and I'm guessing, of course, as always, education is going to be a big issue. Given the support for our schools now, a ballot initiative, should we expect to see some significant funding for education from the lawmakers, kind of a way to show residents that it works better when the lawmakers make those decisions as opposed to the public?
Well, we've been reviewing and looking at some of what we've done. In the last 3 years, we have put over $600 million of new money into education. And that's a sizable increase for the state. Of course, the economy's performed well, and we've had it, and we continue to make that commitment that education is important to us. And part of the reason it's so important is that we have a young workforce, and that's appealing to many of the companies that are looking to relocate into Utah. I think this coming year we will be able to make another substantial contributions to that. And I think at the end of the year, you know, in a 4-year period, I anticipate that we will place $700 to $800 million of new money into the system. So, you know, will we ever get Utah off the very bottom? I don't know. I think that we're making that commitment to do it. When you figure that 100% of our personal income tax goes to education, that's a big commitment that not many other states make. But I think we're making some progress. You know, one of the things that I'm really excited about and have seen, we've seen the school trust fund grow from about $300 million to $2.3 billion. The schools individually, the community councils are getting some significant dollars to do some things that they want to do locally. I think that's been a great asset for education, and I think it'll continue to grow.
What about the push for medical marijuana? Of course, another ballot initiative. We're still waiting for the science, I think, on a legislative need, but will that science be ready for this session?
Well, there's some that will be, but it's, you know, Senator Shiozawa, who has just retired and went on to another position, there is some good work being done by the University of Utah as well as a couple others. I'm in hopes that we start getting some of that information out by the session. They're trying to do that. Whether it'll be enough or not, I don't know, but it is actively being worked on. And if the federal government would allow us, some of our universities, a little better access, I think we could get some testing done, taking if we just change the schedule on it for universities. And that's being worked on. Whether that'll get completed or not, I'm not sure. But I think there's a lot of interest in that. I'm assuming that they will get the, you know, if the polls are right, it appears that it will be a ballot initiative, and I guess the people of Utah will have an opportunity.
Yeah, and I think I caught something this morning, and I didn't hear the full story, but something about the federal government saying that they will now begin enforcing the rule of law, and that means that I think potentially federal government could be cracking down on states that have approved the sale and distribution of marijuana, either for recreational or medicinal uses. And I guess when I look at that, many Republicans say they support state rights, except in this case.
Well, I think that it's an issue that I think the state's rights are still there. We'd like to see that. But, you know, in my other job as working at Zions Bank, one of the issues we got, we still are under federal regulations to not take marijuana money as deposits, and we have some heavy fines leveled at us. You know, they need to – the biggest thing we need to do is try to get leveled up on what we can and can't do and proceed accordingly. You know, there's no question in my mind, I think there are some people that are benefiting from medical marijuana, and I've met with many of those, and I understand their desires. It's just a problem with this battle. I think it is somewhat a state's rights issue, but I think it's overly, the federal government needs to make some decisions and help us get moved to a better position.
Let's talk a little bit about, I mean, this District 26 is so diametrically opposed, I guess, not opposed, but in terms of the values. Here we have in Summit County and Park City governments who hope to see within 4 years net zero carbon emissions and municipal and county operations. On the other hand, where you live, of course, people make their livelihood by more drilling and the extraction of fossil fuels. So how do you square that? I mean, who are you representing, your neighbors or your constituents over here in the west side of things?
Well, and I guess the answer to that is, as I look at the economic engines that are driving both sides of the district, and, you know, I've tried to support and to encourage tourism, because that's a big area, and recreation on the east side. But we have some of it here in on the west side, and we have some here on the east side, as well as, you know, zero carbon emissions, I think, is a great goal. And I think in some areas we'll be able to accomplish that. There's been a lot of progress. But ultimately, for the next 20 to 30 years, we're going to see fossil fuels still a major part of our transportation system. I haven't seen any of the jets flying in and out of burning jet fuel, and that brings people in, you know, and I got through, I met earlier this week with the Sundance Institute and the thousands of people that come in. I mean, we're going to continue to see a mixture. I think we're seeing some decrease in some consumption, but we're also seeing demand worldwide that I think oil is there, but we're also seeing solar is taking off, and it'll continue to let the market work, and eventually we'll get to a balance.
Yeah. Real quick, I just have just a minute left here, but I had heard from some folks in the Heber Valley about maybe their push to ask the state legislature for some of those sales tax revenues that we're seeing brought in as a result of the taxes being collected from Amazon. Online retailer, mostly Amazon.com. Is that something, given that I guess their argument is that it's the rural areas of the state that are driving those Amazon.com sales. Is that something that you've heard about?
Well, there is some discussion about that. I think there'll be some looking at those funds will be distributed probably by a zip code combination. I think that's, I know I've heard some talk about how we're going to balance that out. But the truth of the matter is Amazon is selling as much in the metropolitan areas as it is the rurals. The rurals use it because of the availability of, you know, choice and selection. And so the ultimate thing is we need to work that and make that fair for everyone. You know, the biggest people that have taken the biggest pressure from online sales has been our mom and pops and our Main Street merchants. Stories are out there abundantly where people have come in and looked at a high-end camera, for example, or even a collecting rifle of some sort that's thousands of dollars. And they say, okay, thank you, appreciate that. And they say, okay, do you want me to write this up? And they say, no, I'm going to order it online because I can save 6.8% sales tax and out the door. And that's not a fair issue either. So we'll, you know, that's coming into balance. I think we'll see some issues on that in this session. From what I understand, some of the committees have worked on this summer, and we'll see how those work out.
Okay, I need to leave it there. Senator, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.